The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening, everybody. I'm so glad you're all here tonight, because I think you're in for a real treat. My name is Phyllis Beck, and I'm a member of the Free Library Foundation Board and a proud supporter of this great institution. As I say to my friends all the time, I think the library system as a whole is the greatest cultural institution in this city. I have to tell you something I have just learned about Professor Galbraith. Just last Friday, he was inducted into the Lycaean Academic Society. Now, I have never heard of it, and he informs me there are 180 members, and the society, one of the founders of the society was Galileo. And so I said to him, well, and one does not get to be a member of the society till somebody dies and somebody who's alive takes their seat. And I said to him, well, that sounds like the equivalent of the Nobel Prize. And he said to me, no, it's more exclusive. Let me tell you a little bit about his new book. He collects the notable writings of his father, the renowned economist John Kenneth Galbraith, and he includes them in one volume, and the senior Galbraith's work, as most of you here probably know, included American Capitalism, The Affluent Society, and The New Industrial State. The Wall Street Journal has praised Mr. Galbraith's book enormously. Like his father, Mr. Galbraith is an economist. He has degrees from Harvard, Yale, and Cambridge. And he's a public economist. He does not hide his views in academic journals. He writes for the Texas Observer, The Nation, Mother Jones, and other publications. And from those titles, you can gather which way he leans. He is a severe critic of the Bush War in Iraq, and his economic policy, which I hope he will talk about, is more Keynesian than it is monetaristic. To act out his principles, he is chair of the Economists for Peace and Security, and that is a national association of professional economists concerned with peace and security. Presently, he is the Lloyd M. Benson Jr. Chair in Government Business Relations at the Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas in Austin. His previous books include The Predator State, Balancing Acts, and Created Unequal, all of which examine the different aspects of the distribution of wealth in the United States. Ladies and gentlemen, let's give him a real Philadelphia Library welcome.
Thank you very much indeed, and it's a great pleasure, really, and a privilege to be here. I want to begin by thanking and, in a way, congratulating the Library of America for bringing out this marvelous edition of my father's major works in economics. You were quite right, of course, to say that the review in the Wall Street Journal contained a measure of praise, but that was it was distinctly measured praise. The real purpose of the review was to convey the impression that, except for a little bit of elegant prose, that these books were period pieces and that one did not need to read them. There was a similar reaction from the Weekly Standard. I want tonight to advance the counterclaim that the enduring merits of John Kenneth Galbraith consist in having been the first and the premier economist to integrate John Maynard Keynes, Joseph Schumpeter, the work of Joan Robinson and of E.H. Chamberlain on the firm, and the great American original work of Thorstein Veblen, into a single descriptive and analytical system, forging a comprehensive vision of post-war American capitalism, and doing so in accessible, no, in great prose, so as to outflank the defensive battlements of the economics profession, which then and now consist in turning a blind eye and a deaf ear to critical comment. Let's focus on the young Galbraith and establish who he was and where and how he had developed his ideas. In 1950, he was 42, and he'd settled in to the great Edwardian brick pile on Francis Avenue in Cambridge, Massachusetts, where he would spend the rest of his life, and turned his hand as a newly tenured professor at Harvard to drafting American Capitalism, which is the earliest of the books that are here republished. My father had established technical authority in three major areas. The first was agriculture. He was a farm boy from southern Ontario. He was a farm boy who hated farming. And one of his first escapes from it, as we've learned really quite recently, was to become a tyro journalist for the St. Thomas Post-Dispatch, the local newspaper, for which he wrote a pseudonymous column as a teenager, really, and early in his college years, on all of the agricultural practices of that place and time. He went on to get a PhD at Berkeley in agricultural economics, escaping farm life definitively. And when he came east to take up a lectureship at Harvard, he stopped in Washington and went to work for the Agricultural Adjustment Administration, and later briefly for the American Farm Bureau Federation. Farm economics gave him practical insight into technical change, into price management, and the market dynamics, market power. And including, of course, the history of conflict between farmers and bankers. And that gave him at least one path into into American politics. And there came a moment in the 1960 campaign when John F. Kennedy said to him, "Ken, I don't want to hear about farm policy from anybody but you, and I don't want to hear about it from you either." The second area was price control, and more generally, the management of a wartime mobilization, which he became engaged actually well before the war started, when the problem was, for example, citing of munitions factories and other practical questions of how you got production capacity up for the war that they knew was coming. This brought intimate contact with the structures of industrial power, with the auto companies whose plants had to be taken over for war production over their considerable resistance, with the textile makers whose were pressing always for higher prices even though they were making more profits and living better than they ever had in their lives. With the American households who had to be induced to hold vast quantities of government bonds, which meant they had to be confident that the value of those bonds would not be inflated away. And there was the occasional exercise of raw power. 2 days after Pearl Harbor, although my father did not work for the War Production Board, He nevertheless had drafted with some colleagues, went around to the board and got an order signed by people who were obviously not accustomed to reading what they were asked to sign, and in fact not even for checking the credentials of those who were asking, an order banning the sale of rubber tires in the United States to protect the natural rubber supplies that were endangered by the Japanese drive on Malaya. And he also initiated and got enforced a 35-mile-an-hour speed limit, which had to be done by state governments, which meant calling up the governors and persuading them of the necessity of this task. And I think there were two states which declined to cooperate, and one of them was Texas, whose governor, I think it was Pappy or Daniel, heard my father out and said, "Professor, I understand what you're saying, but in Texas, if you go 35 miles an hour, you don't get there." And the third technical area, which he had mastered at the end of the war, was consequences of strategic bombing, both on Germany and on Japan. Economic effects thereof, or more precisely, the failure of the bombs, despite enormous costs, massive loss of air crews, and the huge and murderous damage inflicted on civilian populations, and the determination of the United States Army Air Forces to justify their mission, what my father and his team of economists, a remarkable group that included Nicholas Kaldor, E.F. Schumacher, Piero Sraffa, E.F. Dennison, a number of substantial figures of that period, and other great public servants, Paul Nitze and George Ball, were able to establish that, in fact, the contribution of the bombing to the war effort had been quite minimal. This caused considerable resistance amongst the Air Force's allies to his promotion to professor at Harvard. One of the leading figures in the Air Force at the time was candid enough to say to him, "The trouble with you, Ken, is that you're too damn honest." To these spheres of practical experience, I'd like to add some of the dominant intellectual themes of that time. The first to mention here was, of course, the work of John Maynard Keynes, who had overthrown the previously dominant notion that mass unemployment could only come as a consequence of the stubborn refusal of workers to accept cuts to their wages, right? Which was the prevailing view. Keynes instead had understood that the Depression was rooted in monetary and financial failure, in a psychology of liquidity preference, that is to say, the desire to hold money and the fear of letting it go into real activity. And in the ensuing failure of what he called aggregate effective demand, total spending power. My father was just young enough to absorb this lesson at a moment in his career when he had not yet committed himself, or almost not yet committed himself, to the opposing errors. The second great theoretical development of the 1930s had been in what was called the theory of the firm, the work of the English economist Joan Robinson, the American economist Edmund Chamberlain, on the intermediate cases between pure monopoly and perfect competition, between the case where just one firm dominates the market and the case where there's so many firms that none of them matter at all. In American Capitalism in 1952, my father pointed out the implication. Quote, "Now there were alternatives to the implausible case of competition without going to the implausible case of monopoly. No sooner had oligopoly been recognized as something different from either competition or monopoly than it was on its way to replace competition as the principal assumption by which the industrial economy was interpreted." Early in his career, and my father, it's fair to say, was drawn first to this structural or interpretation of things. He had seen industrial structure and aggregate demand as competing explanations of the Depression. But now he had worked out that they were really complements. They were parts of the same structure. And it was precisely the fact that the economy was structured into stable basins dominated by mature firms that nullified this fictional and fantastic world of flexible prices in which markets could be counted on to adjust away the difficulty of unemployment if only one would get rid of trade unions and other obstacles, minimum wages and other obstacles to that adjustment. This is what gave aggregate demand management the leverage it required. And for that matter, it gave businesses a stake in controlling the processes of demand management. Both slumps and booms had their place in business strategy. Slumps because they cleared out the competition, gave the advanced firms an advantage over the backward ones, while also disciplining labor unions. Booms because they favored new investment and generated profits and corporate growth. So the conflict over Keynesianism was not just about these abstract policy matters, but really about matters of the distribution of power. It was over whether, not over whether to use Keynesian tools, but to what ends and under whose control. Keynesian policies, if they were aimed at permanently strengthening labor and at damping the business cycle, were an intolerable threat to freedom, if by freedom you mean the freedom of the manager of large enterprises to control events throughout the country. Those who in bringing these concepts together, my father illustrated another aspect of his makeup. He was one of the very few pure economists of his time, an academic whose whole life centered on economic problems. He diverged from theory only toward history and practice. He did not parachute into the subject from, say, 19th century thermodynamics or engineering or mid-late 20th century incipient computer science. He was not a mathematician of the Bourbakian school, say, of the pure postulate theorem type. And there were many, of course, who fit those descriptions, and they aggressively and somewhat ironically defined themselves as the real economists, ruling those who actually studied the real economy out of the discipline or attempting to. And yet their work had necessarily abstracted from both the central problems of the 1930s, high theory, the monetary origins of demand, and the implications of complex industrial structure. Thus, formalism went to war with realism, a war which is always won by formalism inside the academy and by realism in the outside world. Certain of the formalists, Paul Samuelson, Robert Solow, Milton Friedman, maintained feet in both on both stages by adopting a lowbrow realism for practical purposes while they spoke to their formalistic colleagues in a language indecipherable from the outside, whereas Galbraith always spoke in the same voice to everyone at some cost in this particular form of academic prestige. To their credit, I should say, the rigorous formalists of our own time, who continue to dominate academic economics, have mostly abandoned the public stage altogether, and they are unknown in politics and public life. They must realize that their models with their representative rational agents with perfect foresight can never be made to seem sensible to ordinary practical people. The hallmarks of of American Capitalism and the Affluent Society, two of the four books reproduced in this volume, are that they maintained contact with the prevailing textbook teaching, with the timeless backdrops of Adam Smith, David Ricardo, Karl Marx, Thorsten Veblen, John Maynard Keynes, and also with the emerging managerial economics of that moment. The work, let's say, of Burley and Means, of James Burnham, of Herbert Simon, sociologists and organization theorists who were coming to grips in a serious way, as many formal economists were not, with what the American economy really was, and with the outlook that was developing in some of the then-emerging business schools. These books are about economic ideas, and except for the fact that no book which deals with its time and place can expect to account for events that come afterward, they are very far from being period pieces. They are, in fact, works that come to grips with fundamental and, I think, almost timeless issues of economic theory. Let me read to you a short passage from American Capitalism, describing the interactions of business and government in the American political season of 1948. There was little evidence that businessmen, more especially their leaders, viewed their prospects with equanimity. On the contrary, the tone of business statements during these years was that of a communique promising a last-ditch stand against disaster. Thus, in early 1948, the weekly organ of the nation's leading business organization, the NAM News, observed that the President's State of the Union message promised, quote, impossible burdens for business, and quoted approvingly the view of an unnamed conservative politician that if enacted, the program would, quote, first hobble and then ultimately destroy the American business system. And what was the threat in Harry Truman's 1948 State of the Union message? American Capitalism doesn't actually say, but you can look it up. The speech is available, and it gives a pretty clear answer. Truman said, "We are rightly proud of the high standards of medical care we know how to provide in the United States. The fact is, however, that most of our people cannot afford to pay for the care they need. I have often and strongly urged that this condition demands a national health program. The heart of the program must be a national system of payment for medical care." Isn't it clear that in his ear for the whining of the business lobbyist, my father indeed had the instinct of timeless truth? That the Great Crash was a summer's work of genius, I think, is indisputable. And if anyone did dispute it, this is an area where the market can judge. The book was on the bestseller lists as recently as last year. And there are new editions always coming out. A Croatian one just crossed my desk the other day. And I think Macedonian is in progress. But I cannot resist also reading a brief passage from that work, which has, I think you will agree, a certain bearing on our time. My father wrote, "To the economist, embezzlement is the most interesting of crimes. Alone amongst various forms of larceny, it has a time parameter. Weeks, months, or years may elapse between the commission of a crime and its discovery. This is a period, incidentally, when the embezzler has his gain, and the man who has been embezzled, oddly enough, feels no loss. There is a net increase in psychic wealth. At any given time, there exists an inventory of undiscovered embezzlement in, or more precisely, not in, the country's businesses and banks. The inventory, it should perhaps be called the bezel, amounts at any moment to many millions of dollars. It also varies in size with the business cycle. In good times, people are relaxed, trusting in money is plentiful. But even though money is plentiful, there are always many people who need more. Under these circumstances, the rate of embezzlement grows, the rate of discovery falls off, and the bezel increases rapidly. In depression, all this is reversed. Money is watched with a narrow, suspicious eye. The man who handles it is assumed to be dishonest unless he proves himself otherwise. Audits are penetrating and meticulous. Commercial morality is enormously improved." I quote this in part to dispel the idea that my father lacked a mathematical eye. Let me just devote a few words to the new industrial state, the fourth and most largest entry in this volume. It was my father's most ambitious work. And notwithstanding that, when it first appeared in 1967, it rose to the top of the bestseller lists and stayed there for over a year. It threatened to move economics entirely away from the sterile discussion of competitive markets and firmly into a discourse about major corporations and the use of power. The professional reaction was furiously adverse. Robert Solo called it a coffee table book and intimated that my father was a beautiful person. The exchange that this provoked will still set off a Geiger counter if you run it over your bookshelf. And it was so much so that when I asked Bob, who is a very great economist and a good person, to speak at a memorial conference on my father in 2008, my mother was a little bit skeptical. But Bob did speak beautifully on that occasion, and I think at least posthumously the relationship was repaired. So what is the place of John Kenneth Galbraith in the modern world? The Affluent Society, the leading title of this volume, was in many ways the founding text of modern American liberalism, providing analytical foundations and popular arguments for the consumer movement, the environmental movement, some respects for the women's movement. The great crash is, of course, today's history written a half century ago, capturing all the major features of the folly and crookery that can and does lead to financial disaster and economic collapse. And I have argued elsewhere that to understand the ugly and depressing fate of much of American industry in the last 30 or 40 years, shattered by competition, crippled by the resurgence of financial power, broken apart by the exodus of technology firms from under the mantle of a large corporation, that all of this can really only be understood properly if you take the world of the 1960s as described in the new industrial state as your point of departure. But let me close by returning to the least familiar of these books, and the oldest, the first, American Capitalism. There is in it a brilliant, tight little chapter on Keynes called The Depression Psychosis. Which considers in part the impact of Keynes's thinking on conventional political ideas. Galbraith wrote to explain why, in spite of its obviously hugely favorable effect on business profits and its basic stance of non-intervention in business management, why it was still the case that business leaders were so often and so violently allergic to Keynes. Here's the passage. For a doctrine that excluded government, it substituted one that made government indispensable. Keynes was sufficiently unpalatable when he made depression and inflation not adventitious or war-induced misfortunes, but normal occurrences. He went on to make government the indispensable partner of business. In failing to recognize the prestige that goes with power and decision-making in American life, American liberals failed to recognize that for some businessmen, the Keynesian remedy was at least as damaging as the depression it presumed to eliminate. Even though the businessmen might profit in a narrow pecuniary sense from the new role of government, there was no chance his prestige would survive intact. And so today, as we contemplate the masters of Wall Street, who so failed to foresee how their own practices would produce financial and economic collapse, as we listened to them inveighing against public deficits and public debt and public initiative of all kinds, and doing all they can to ensure that full recovery never happens. This flash of insight seems as though it could have been written last week. And so today, when the financiers and their wise men are once again in charge, when their views and slogans dominate the media and are voiced by the president himself, when their top men run the government more or less nakedly on their behalf, then to some people, power relationships are as they should be. And from a certain point of view, all is right with the world. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Professor Galbraith. And I have a feeling we're going to jump right into a lot of questions. I know G.B. Shaw that said that if you put all the economists in a row, they'd never reach a conclusion. I have a feeling we'll hear a few tonight here. Who'd like to get us started? Off to the left there.
Thank you for coming to the Free Library. I wonder what you and your father would say about the recent commission recommendations for dealing with the current deficit and level of debt at the federal government level.
Ah, well, I certainly can tell you what I'm saying about them. I testified before the Bowles-Simpson Commission on the 30th of June, or more precisely, I sent in testimony because they were allowing 4 minutes per witness, and it didn't seem worth making a physical trip to Washington for that. What I said at the time was that if you take the mandate of the commission seriously to reduce debt and deficits in the long run, the only way to do this is as was done over the period between 1946 and 1980, when the debt-to-GDP ratio fell from 120+% to about 33%. And how did that happen? By the development of the private economy, by the construction of a successful and reasonably disciplined financial sector, which extended credit and therefore permitted the private economy to pay taxes that were commensurate with the burdens that were growing at that time. And that's what happened. The idea that you can reduce debts and deficits by cutting back on spending or by raising taxes is utterly illusory in the face of the problems that we currently have. How does the Congressional Budget Office deal with this? The answer is it assumes away the problems that we currently have. And if you look at the forecast of the CBO, they have us going back to full employment in 5 years. They have no policy that makes this a plausible forecast, but it sets the stage for creating a different kind of deficit out of another set of equally implausible assumptions. So the whole thing is an exercise which is confected out of an inconsistent and implausible official forecasting process, and is being used by the leaders of the Deficit Commission, and certainly in some cases by members of the Deficit Commission as well, to advance the longstanding agenda of cutting back on the New Deal and the Great Society, of cutting back on Social Security and cutting back on Medicare in particular, but also cutting back on the mortgage interest deduction and on the earned income tax credit, which actually is a Reagan-era success story of that substantially reduced wage poverty in the United States. And each one of these is being put on the chopping block in the service of an utterly indefensible analytical framework and a false objective, an objective that will never be achieved by these means.
Another question. A gentleman right here on the aisle.
I have a question, Professor Galbraith, on the other side of that equation, and that is the QE2. And what you would have to say of QE2, is it anything more than a bank bailout?
QE2 is the second wave of quantitative easing, and it's essentially the policy of the Federal Reserve to buy back long-term Treasury bonds in specified quantities, thereby flooding the markets with cash. Is it a bailout for the banks? I have not been able to persuade myself that it really is, because the banks, what it does is, at least what it's supposed to do, is flatten the yield curve. And the banks have been living off the yield curve. In other words, borrowing from the central bank at zero and lending back to the Treasury at 3 or 4% and doing nothing. So that doesn't strike me as quite being the right explanation. The debate over this, as I think many of you are aware, is between, the main criticism is coming from a part of the economics profession and political allies who are afraid or pretend to be afraid that it's going to produce a wave of inflation and a collapse of the dollar. I think that's extremely implausible. It's extremely implausible because we're sitting at 10% unemployment and we have an open economy and wage rates are not going to go up because the Federal Reserve is providing extra reserves to the banking system. Come to you in a second. What is likely to happen, therefore, in my view, is very little. And I think, in fact, we have already seen that the effects of this announcing this policy were initially that people bought U.S. Treasuries long-term and the rates fell, and the dollar fell, and the stock market went up. And as of a couple of weeks ago, the policy's in place, and everybody is beginning to come around to the view that nothing's going to happen, and there's a sell-off, and the treasuries have fallen, rates have risen, the dollar has risen, and the stock market has fallen. So looks like it's already pretty much a dead letter, which is exactly what happened in Japan, when they pursued the policy for 5 or 6 years, at least in the early part of the 2000s. So why they're doing it beats me. It may be simply that this is one of these cases where a particular bureaucracy wanted to give the impression that it was being helpful with the only tools that it had available, and whether they recognize or not that those tools are almost utterly ineffective in this situation is a question that touches on whether they understand the situation and whether they're really competent for dealing with it, which are the issues that I would raise.
Sir? I have a gentleman about 6 rows back. Yeah.
This is a question about economics and ecology. I just happened to be looking at the CO2 curve, noticing that about 1950 is when its slope begins really increasing quickly. How do you match economics, which tends to be about producing more out of the earth, mm-hmm. with ecology, which talks about the effects of having produced more from the earth?
Well, you're right, of course. It's this post-war period, which was in some ways built on the industrial structure that was created in the Second World War, which has given us the oncoming ecological disaster of climate change. What do we do about it now? I think the answer is that if we were serious about it, we would be. This would be the primary topic of our political conversation. How do we change the way we use energy? How do we change the way we produce energy? How do we redesign our patterns of life so as to get the emission of greenhouse gases permanently down to a level consistent with the carrying capacity of the Earth. There have been a few economists, really beginning in the 1970s, who have addressed these issues in a systematic way, but the economics profession has been almost totally resistant to them and continues to throw up rather, in my view, specious difficulties. These are questions where it does not make sense to discount the future at a commercial rate of interest. Because the fact is that your grandchildren aren't around now to make their preferences felt, and I'm sure they would rather not have sea levels rising uncontrollably and food supplies running out. But that's the situation that they or their grandchildren may face. And the one of the things that troubles me most enormously about the dominance of these accounting issues, debts and deficits, is that they distract us from taking a serious approach to the problems that we actually have. One of them is unemployment. Right? One of them is the failure of the economy to absorb the labor that's available. And the other major one is this complex of infrastructure, energy, and environmental questions, which, as I say, if we were serious about the long-term future of the country and the planet, would be at the top of our agenda and our public discourse, not constantly being brushed off the table by people talking about whether the United States government is going to go bankrupt, which is not going to happen.
On the aisle here.
Professor, you paint a very negative picture, and I'm disturbed by hearing all of it. Can you give us something reassuring? I mean, don't we have economists advising our president that have the right idea, or are they all going in the wrong direction? I'd like to hear something positive from you, if we can. What can we do? Because when you say they're going in the wrong direction and their methods will never lead to the goals that they espouse, I get very nervous about mixing politics with economics. How can we separate the two?
Well, you must be a glutton for disappointment. Having heard my message, you invite me to repeat it. Let me speak to the decision authorities and what I think has happened here. In the administrations that my father played a role in, Roosevelt certainly, as a young man, preeminently Kennedy, and to some degree Johnson, the president maintained a pretty wide range of contacts. Cosmic in Johnson's case. Kennedy's was pretty wide. And those contacts were sometimes in his administration, sometimes not in it. And when he didn't feel he was getting sufficiently good advice or sufficient range of advice from his closest advisors, he went around them. I have no sense of that happening in this administration. What happened at the top of the administration from the very beginning was that the major economic posts were filled by people who had an enormous stake in the previous administration's policies. Secretary Geithner had been president of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. Chairman Bernanke was reappointed. And then we had Larry Summers, who was brought in, and Larry was a figure from the Clinton administration where he had been a major player in the deregulation and desupervision of the financial system, in particular the repeal of Glass-Steagall. So that signaled where the main lines of advice would come from. And so far as we know, the only modest broadening of that came from a figure like Christina Romer, who was early excluded and is now gone. So the administration was captured, and one has to conclude that the president wished it to be captured by forces of continuity acting in the same interests as the previous administration. And you know, even if you believe, which I don't, but even if you believe that the previous administration was doing the best it could, right? I mean, I'm from Texas, I always used to say to Texas political audiences that I was a great follower of George Bush's, that I followed him to Andover, and I followed him to both Harvard and Yale. I followed him to Texas, and then I stopped. But if you give them, stretch your imaginations and give them the benefit of the doubt. When a new administration comes in, under these conditions, it is necessary to change policy. And you can't change policy if you're giving the decision authority to people who have a stake in their own past decisions. It's as simple as that. And that was, in my view, the original failure of this administration. What they should have done was, at the beginning of this administration, to take a realistic view of the banks, of the major banks, and to follow the law, and to give the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation the go-ahead to take the necessary steps, which would have meant placing some major institutions into receivership and reorganizing them. The financial sector would have been downsized, its powers would have been curtailed, its lobbies would have been weakened. The whole climate of politics in Washington would be different from what it is, and you wouldn't have had this development in which basically the bankers had everything they wanted, but nobody else was feeling any benefits, which led to the political disaster of a week or so ago. Sir.
Good evening, Dr. Galbraith. Two questions. First question would be, was there or in fact a relationship between your father and Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.? And what was that relationship? And the second question would be, are we really on or the new frontier economically in that at the level of a $1 trillion deficit, as an accounting factor, are we, in a sense, being led by a dog that's chasing its tail, and that we won't acknowledge that the $1 trillion level suggests that we have a whole new set of demands on our economic policy?
The $1 trillion level of?
Deficit.
Of deficit. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Well, let me answer the first question first. I'm actually very touched by that question because I have a vivid childhood memory of being taken with my brother, I think, Peter, to the Boston Common on a rainy afternoon in, I think it would have been 1965, to hear Dr. King speak, and of meeting him briefly in what I now imagine was a hotel lobby of something of that nature, near there afterwards, and just shaking his hand. So I can tell you firsthand that there was communication between my father and Dr. King. My understanding, and I have not seen correspondence to verify this, is that there was also correspondence, there must have been, which dealt with the role that Dr. King might play in mobilizing opposition to the Vietnam War and merging, in effect, the civil rights and the anti-war movements, particularly in this post-1965 period when the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act had been enacted. And, of course, that happened. There is something, some substance to the in the response to your question. Exactly how much, in terms of written communication or records, at this point I could not say, and I don't think there's a treatment of it in Richard Parker's biography. Yeah, go ahead. No, I did not know that. I did not know that. That's magnificent. Thank you. I'll tell you another, just this, that's actually tremendously moving. I have on my shelf in Austin, a volume of the Affluent Society in Greek, and it was meticulously rebound with matchsticks by four Greek professors of economics who did that to pass the time while they were imprisoned by the junta in 1967. And they sent it to my father after they were released. So that's just touching on some of the effect that this book had in the wider world. Okay, to your second question, which I've practically about the deficits. If you don't mind, just giving me a quick.
Mm-hmm. That means essentially $1 trillion has been spent, or $1 trillion is in the mm-hmm. How we account for it is by counting it as a deficit. The question will be, do we have the wherewithal, I guess philosophically or morally, to acknowledge where the money is?
I think one way to think about this is to recognize that in history, the government almost always runs a deficit. That is to say, it spends more than it takes in taxes. And it's not just our government. It's every government of a significant society. I mean, not an oil sheikdom, but every serious country does this all the time. And the only exceptions are periods of credit booms when the private sector grows pretty rapidly, and the effect of running a surplus is to choke off that growth. Because taxes come out of people's pockets more than spending puts in, and the private sector contracts. We've done that 6 or 7 times since 1790, and there has been a bust every single time. In the 1830s, Andrew Jackson paid off the debt entirely and produced the Deep Depression. In 2000, Bill Clinton ran a surplus for 3 years. Larry Summers was gaily predicting that in 13 years the debt would be paid off. But in fact, 3 years of surplus was sufficient to choke off the boom, and we had the decline, which actually George Bush inherited. So deficits are normal. When the private sector undergoes a collapse, deficits get to be very large, necessarily. Almost all of that is collapse in tax revenues, plus the automatic things that happen, unemployment insurance, disability, and so forth, people taking early retirement who wouldn't otherwise do so. This is not only normal, it prevents us from going to 25% unemployment and having a complete breakdown. So the word deficit is, I think, in fact, chosen to convey a negative sort of psychic relationship to what's happening. But in reality, if you think about the deficit is to the underlying economic situation as the antibiotic is to the disease, and it is a mistake of statistics to say that just because antibiotics are taken by sick people that if we curtail the antibiotics, they'll get better, right? I don't know any doctor, in fact, in the last 50 or 60 years who holds that position, but economists get confused on the point all the time.
So before we wrap up, I want to throw you a softball. Three mm-hmm. things you do to change the economy to get us on what you would consider the right track in order.
Three things that I would do. the first thing you have to do is you have to address the massive fraud that destroyed the banking system. One of the basic propositions, which actually flows out of my father's work in important ways, is that advanced economies only survive if there is an appropriate and effective system of regulation that creates trustworthy institutions. And when trust is allowed to be destroyed, it's a very serious situation because that's not something that can be rebuilt easily. It's something which the whole process of development in some ways is about building up trust and reducing transactions cost, reducing the cost of doing business in advanced with advanced technologies and complex networks. We allowed that, the government allowed that to be destroyed over the last 20 years in the financial sector, massively destroyed. Millions of mortgages being issued that were counterfeits, that were never going to be paid, that were going to default in 3 years, sold to the larger investing public with the laundering of the AAA rating from the ratings agencies, fenced by commercial and investment banks to gullible individuals and funds, who are actually, Michael Lewis tells us that was a word in the industry for the buyers of these things, it was Dusseldorf. That's one of the largest, frankly, criminal operations in the history of American finance, and it must be dealt with by juridical means. Point number one. The Justice Department needs to have a strike force going after this in a major way. Point number two. We have a lot of people, 11 million roughly at the moment, who are out of work or never found work in the first place because of the crisis. That's a lot of people. And no matter how aggressively the government takes this on, it's not going to be able to find jobs for all of them, and particularly for older workers who are obliged to fill out obliged to look for work every month in order to qualify for unemployment insurance. This is a futile waste. Allow people to retire. Give them an incentive and the capacity to go on to Social Security at a higher level of benefits than they get now at a younger age for a few years until this group of people is safely out of the labor force and becoming a source of demand for work rather than competition for the supply. Right. So, number three, support states and localities for the duration of the crisis so they're not cutting essential public services, teaching, parks, libraries, fire, police. Libraries, did I mention libraries? Right. There should be, this is an environment where we should not be cutting these services. We should be preserving them as best we can for better times. Is when they get cut as a result of the crisis of system of federalism and the crisis of state and local governments, then the damage is cumulative. Okay, you asked for three. I'll give you the fourth. From the standpoint of building up going forward, and this comes back to the question that came in earlier, we need to set a new strategic direction. And that the problems that have to be solved, I think, are reasonably well known to us all. The major problems that we face have to do with our infrastructure, with energy, with the environment. That's a complex set of issues. Some of it would require advanced technologies, new technological developments. Some of it is about rebuilding and restructuring the way we live so that we can live reasonably well on a smaller energy bill. Right? That's something you could, with the right design, the right institutions, keep a whole generation or two employed doing. And we should set about doing that with the understanding that if the public sector does its job right, then the private sector will get into the act, and you'll have the combination of public and private activity, which gives you satisfactory economic expansion.
Is healthcare number five? Is healthcare number five? On your list, dealing with health care?
Well, of course, we've gone through the health care exercise. I think we'll have to go through another one in a few years, but this one has to play itself out. What troubles me, I mean, a number of good things were done in this bill. What troubles me about it is that I think it creates a world in which the price of insurance will simply go up, and people who are healthy will drop out and avoid the mandates, so that you'll end up with a different set of problems. And ultimately, I mean, we have to resolve this the way every well-organized country has resolved it, with some form of single-payer insurance or comprehensive scheme.
Professor James Galbraith, thank you. Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.